Welcome to Community Air on Coast Community Radio. For tonight's pre-recorded episode, we bring you the final speaker of the Columbia Forum's 27th season, Buzz Bissinger. Buzz is among the nation's most honored and distinguished writers. A native of New York City, Buzz is the winner of the Pulitzer Prize, the Livingston Award, the American Bar Association Silver Gavel Award, and the National Headliners Award, among others. He also was a Nieman Fellow at Harvard University. He's the author of the highly acclaimed nonfiction books Friday Night Lights, A Prayer for the City, Three Nights in August, Shooting Stars, and Father's Day. He was also the ghostwriter for Caitlyn Jenner's new memoir, The Secrets of My Life. Buzz has been a reporter for some of the nation's most prestigious newspapers, a magazine writer with published work in Vanity Fair, The New York Times Magazine, and Sports Illustrated, and a co-producer and writer for the ABC television drama NYPD Blue. Without further ado, here's Buzz Bissinger with Coming to Astoria at the Columbia Forum.
Thank you very much. There will be time for questions, and you can ask questions about anything and everything. I thought I'd try to be a little bit more personal about, you know, people do often ask me, and I've often wondered, you know, how and why. Why do they become a writer? When I was young, I didn't keep a journal. I really didn't write anything. What I really, frankly, did at a young age was brood and sulk and be largely morose and gravitate towards the melancholic. In other words, I had all the personality traits of a writer, even if I wasn't one. I did have a heightened sensitivity, and this is serious, a really hypersensitivity. And when you have that kind of sensitivity, you do live in a certain amount of fear that when you say something or do something, it'll be wrong, or you'll be ridiculed, or you'll feel humiliated. I wasn't lonely. I don't want to paint this dire picture. I actually had a lot of friends, and I could be funny, and I could be a smartass like a lot of kids are. But I always felt a certain discomfort inside, maybe because I knew I was different in many ways. There was a lack of confidence that I masked, like many people do, by acting confident. And I think I did feel lonely in some ways, a lack of connection. I came from a wonderful family, an extended family of talkers. My parents, my sister, my grandparents, my uncle, my aunt, cousins, and they were the type of family that not only had one opinion about everything, but often two that were diametrically opposed to each other, and they could care less as long as they could keep on talking. I really did not know where I fit in. And so I began to make connection by observing, just by walking, by observing. For me, it was a way, without knowing that I would become a journalist, because your eyes are the most important, essential part of being a journalist, it was my way of holding on to something, something that I didn't have to explain, something that I didn't have to justify, something that was all my own. And I wonder if I became a writer, in my case, a nonfiction writer, a journalist, because still to this day, I just like to look. I grew up in New York City in the 1960s, and if there was ever a place that lent itself to observation, it was New York. Back then, it was a cauldron. It was crazy. Anger, chaos, endless garbage strikes, teacher strikes, newspaper strikes. Everybody seemed to be fighting with each other, hating one another. It did feel, as a kid, and it was exciting, it felt on the verge of sort of spontaneous combustion. That just New York was going to go up in flames for no reason at any second. The kind of place that always felt hot, even when it was cold. In other words, the absolutely best place for a would-be writer and journalist to grow up. And I remember doing this without really knowing it, but I remember I began to study the overflowing garbage cans that you pretty much could see on every possible street corner of New York, because they didn't pick them up then. And I remember trying to figure out, I don't know why, who had placed what where? Why was that piece of garbage there? Who would put it there? When they put it there on top of the whole stack, didn't they know that everything would fall over? I was fascinated. I was mesmerized by garbage because it was also, to me, part of what a city should be. which is chaos, craziness, unpredictability, which I feel New York no longer has. When I walked down the sidewalk, I wondered, why was that crack there? Who had made that crack? What about those splotches? Was it blood? Was it sweat? Was it tears? And what about these tiny rivers of grime? I love Times Square, the old Times Square. I hate the new Times Square. Because the old Times Square, when you're a kid or an adult, and even after you've been arrested for doing something bad, which I wasn't, Josh, so don't get excited. It was the best show in town, in the world. It really was, absolutely free. This assemblage of hustlers and hookers and hobos, and in this choppy sea of X-rated theaters and open 24-hour-a-day porn shops and all these electric lights. It was fantastic. So if you're looking for something to observe, if you're looking for something to connect to, basically as a writer, what do? You internalize and then you try to externalize. I truly felt alive in Times Square. I felt every fiber of my heart and soul, I felt stimulation because that's what you want when you create. And I don't care whatever field it is. I don't care. You need to feel stimulated. If you don't feel stimulated, it's not going to fly. And it was later in life, several years later, as a teenager, I began to wonder, can I take these observations, can I take these feelings that are arousing me and exciting me and make my heart beat a little faster, and can I somehow put them on paper? Can I do that? Can I make those feelings so private, in a sense, become public on the page, to take you there, to make you feel it? People have often asked me about the impetus for Friday Night Lights, the book that won't die. It's kind of the Energizer Bunny of books at this point. 26 years and we're still fucking talking about it. I forget we're on the radio, sorry. I've always said, and this is true, I always said, and this was partially true, it was a cross-country trip that was the impetus. And I remember taking it in my early 30s. I was a young man then, I'm not now. In the 1980s, and I remember going through all these small towns and seeing these gleaming, bejeweled, immaculate high school football stadiums and thinking there was a heartbeat there, there was a pulse there, they meant something more. They were temples, they were shrines. But the impetus actually, and I'm going to read a little bit, started before that. Once again, just by observing, just by looking and taking those observances and saying, why are you looking at that? What does it mean? Does it symbolize something? Can you put it on paper? And in this case, let me just share this with you, if I can see, which I can't. God, I'm old. It's so depressing. Hey, no wisecracks from the wife. Across the country, there were thousands of places just like Odessa. Places that were not only isolated, but insulated. Places that had gone through the growing pains of America without anyone paying attention. Places that existed as islands unto themselves with no link to the great cities, except that they all sang the same national anthem to the same flag at sporting events. They were the kind of places that you saw from a plane on a clear night if you happened to look out the window. A concentration of little beaded dots breaking up the empty landscape with several veins leading in and out, and then bleak emptiness once again. It was a view that every traveler had seen a million times before. And maybe if you were a passenger on a plane bisecting the night, you looked down and saw those lights, and maybe you wondered, what would it be like to live in an Odessa? To inhabit one of those infinitesimal dots, to be in a place that seems so painfully far away from everything, so completely out of the mainstream of life. Perhaps you wondered what values people held on to in a place like that, what they cared about. Or perhaps you went back to your book, eager to get as far away as possible from that yawning maw that seemed so unimaginable, so utterly unimportant. And that was the impetus, looking out the window of a plane into those plains and those prairies and saying, who lived there? What would they do? What would they hold on to? And then within me saying, I want to live in a place like that. I want to see, which is why I gravitated towards Texas. I'm now 62. I wrote Friday Night Lights when I was 35. I've been a journalist for over 40 years. But I'm still looking out the window, so to speak. My eyes are not as fresh as they used to be. And a journalist is only as good as his eyes. A journalist is only as good as his willingness to use his legs and get out there and report and knock on doors and do all sorts of things that are intrusive. I don't like doing it. I really don't like talking to people anymore because I like to talk. But I find it a strange exchange. Who's in control? The relationship between the journalist and the subject. But I'm always still looking, as a writer, as a person, for places that get to me, that move me in some way. And then, as a writer, to see if there is behind these emotional feelings, this connection, there is a strong enough story that can be told on the page. And as I say, it is the way I try to live my life, to be in the presence of something that is endlessly stimulating, something that is epic, something that is different, something that you haven't seen, which does bring me to a story. And I mean this. It was close to 20 years ago that I saw it for the first time. Lisa, my brilliant wife, and I were in our courting days. This was, what, 1998 or 1990 then. She told me, I always say she's beautiful, but now I have to say she's brilliant. Which she is. You are both beautiful and brilliant.
Thank you.
You are. You are. No, you are. You are. You are. And so am I. Forget it. You know. I'm from the East. If you don't quip, you're an idiot. Lisa and I were our courting days. I think it was 1998 or 1999. And she was insistent. She had lived in the Northwest for almost 25 years. She loved the Northwest. And it was kind of like passing a test. She wanted to see if I would like the Northwest, if I connected to it, what I felt about it. And she wanted me to see, and this is true, as much as I possibly could. And we stayed at the Southwester in Seaview, and this was way before the rodents of Portlandia took it over and it became a place for hipsters. I'm sorry. Shut up. Oh, sorry. You're brilliant, you're beautiful. Don't interrupt. Honey, come on. Matt, why don't you come up here and continue the introduction? This is my life, folks. Get used to it. Anyway, it was April. I think it was April. Lisa, I think, said it was March. I think it was April. Now, I want to say these are only my recollections. Mine. Not Lisa's, mine. I may be wrong about all. I don't even know if this happened, actually. However, as I continue, it was, I remember, there was no sun. It wasn't pouring rain. It was just sort of spitting rain. And it was the kind of place, it just seemed really, really cold. And as we headed towards the Pacific, this was in Seaview, I did ask Lisa, I said, how many nice days do you get out here? And Lisa said, what, are you kidding? This is a nice day.
Every day is a nice day out here. Come on, you know that.
Is there a bouncer? We need security. But then, and honey, let me finish. This is harder than I thought. I do realize something parenthetically, that this is the only place in history where I've spoken. I could drink wine and smoke grass off my ass and not get arrested as long as I didn't drive. Right? Is that right? I mean, how cool is that? That is so cool. Mazel tov. Right. Josh is getting nervous. But we did. I do remember this. We walked on the beach, and the Pacific was roiling. It was spectacular. It was beautiful. It was angry. It's all that you expect from the ocean. And we were the only ones there, and I don't really care about the weather because I could not believe How was it to be in this spot, this most magnificent ocean in the world, on this beach, and there was no one else there? It was incredible. It was just incredible. And how epic that was. And I kept pinching myself because I've spent a lot of time in the Atlantic. But we were the only ones there. It was like this was our backyard. We owned it. We owned it. And I couldn't believe it. And then we did. We headed towards Astoria. And I think it was the first time I'd ever been in Oregon. And I had never seen any of this. And we went across the Megler. And I'm not saying this to please any of you. For my money, it is the greatest bridge in America.
Yeah.
It is. Because the way it's built, you feel like you're skimming the Columbia. You feel like you're skimming. You feel like you're on top of it. You feel like you're gliding on it. And then it takes that arc. And the bridge would arc high, and then you could see the first hills of the hills of Astoria. And how cool it was to me, because I am an Easterner, going from Washington to Oregon on a bridge. I mean, it was just incredible. And then you get towards Astoria, and now it was really raining. but I did feel like I was entering another world. I really did. I'd never seen a place like this. And someone, it may have been you, Josh, who said, what's interesting about Astoria, someone is either running to it or running away for something to get to it. It is the end of the world as we know it in some ways. But I was mesmerized because I did feel that rapid beating in the heart. There was an intrigue. There was an excitement. I had never seen a place like this, never seen a place that was had that much potential, was that beautiful. The Columbia, the hills, the ocean, all of it. The lore, the legacy, Lewis and Clark, the graveyard of the Pacific. I mean, you can imagine all of it. It was the most magnificent setting for a town that I think I had ever seen. And also, I'd never seen a more remote setting for a town. And I remember Lisa is very loyal, and she turned the radio to KMUN. And I remember this. There was something warm about KMUN. There was something cozy about it. It was something that was utterly non-fussy about it. It really did feel like being with a really good friend who had a slight case of Alzheimer's. Not everything is perfect. It was perfect. And sometimes you guys forgot things, but it was a really good session. And I loved that. I loved it because it was real. It was real. It's what radio should be. It's what community should be. It was real. And I kept saying to Lisa, what is that dead space? What happened to the song? And she said, never mind. Never mind. There was no Graham back then. Never mind. Let it go. And who is that snoring on the air? Who is that? But that's Astoria. It is. It's quirky. It's different. It's unique. And at that point in time, strange. And I mean this, it was spooky. Because we went up and we went by the Flavel House, which was totally boarded up and looked like the Psycho House. It did. And then I knew the town was not only different, it was haunted. And as I read more about it, more of the Flavels and Harry, or one of the Flavels carrying his 90-year-old mother in a car for 2 years, I realized the place was crazy and not simply haunted. But it was part of the lore of this place, this crazy, funky family that had run the town for years. And the history was wonderful. The fur traders, Astor, the canneries, the loggers. One of the best stories I ever heard about Astoria, and I may be apocryphal, but I was 5 or 10 years ago. Josh, you'll know this. What's that sex club? Annie's? Is that what it's called? Yeah. Well, you know what? In the Northwest, we know it's true. We know what sex clubs are. The Northwest, that's a sex club. But someone told me a fight broke out between the fishermen and the loggers. And the police were called, and the police took one walk and turned back around and said, we're not getting near that place. And as we drove through town, this is just observations, it seemed like all the men had very long beards. And even though it was raining really hard at this point, no one carried an umbrella, no one wore a raincoat, no one had any hats on, as if it wasn't raining at all. Like, what's your problem? You could tell that the town had seen better days. As I learned about the history, I wore how many? 128 canneries. That was a place that was alive with fishing and shipping and logging. And like many American towns all over this great land, it had seen better days. But I mean this, you could tell right then and there, and I felt it was embedded with something magnificent, something that was singular, something that I think is the most valuable quality of all, if we can do it, and I don't do it all the time. It was utterly authentic, totally authentic. And we didn't, stay very long. We hadn't brought our oars to get through the floods at that point. And we went back across the Megler, and I had no idea if I would ever be back. In fact, I didn't think I ever would be. But the great thing about life is that you just never know. And several years later, Lisa, who I think all of you have met at this point, became the station manager of KMUN. And we bought a beautiful and tiny little cottage in Seaview. Once again, that is a suburb of Astoria. We loved it. We would spend, Lisa spent more time because she was working here. We loved it. We loved coming here. It was a getaway. It was always epic. It was beautiful. Even the trailer homes were beautiful. And now we have a home in Long Beach, and we sold our home in Philadelphia to be in Long Beach. I still go back and forth to Philadelphia. My children are there. I have lived there on and off for 40 years. But I have to say that I'm someone from the East Coast. I love cities, and I have to confess that I do miss the sound of garbage trucks in the morning. And Philadelphia has a lot of that sound every morning right outside my window. But this is our permanent home. We vote here. We complain about the weather here. I'm not sure what we're complaining about because we know it rains every goddamn day. But every day we are awestruck by the epic magnificence that surrounds us. Whether it's the ocean, whether it's the Columbia, the greatest river in the country, whether it's Willapa Bay, whether it's the hills, whether it's the fog coming off the hills, whether it's on a clear day you can see the mountains. And I mean this, sometimes it doesn't seem real. Sometimes you pinch yourself. I still feel something in my heart every time I cross the Megler. And now I see the hills of a city, a town that has completely transformed, that is completely rejuvenated, that has put on a new coat of clothing, but has not lost its authenticity. And one of my favorite things about the Megler is you always look to the left as you're driving to Astoria, and you see those magnificent cargo ships. And I always wonder, where are they going? Do they drink a lot on board? Who do they have sex with? I do. I think about this.
You don't need to know that.
How big are their beds? If you're really tall, do you put a bed together? I mean, I think about this. What do they watch on satellite television? And do they ever get bored? Or do they wish they were doing something else? But it's just that epic string of ships waiting to go on the ocean. Because that is such a magnificent, such a romantic voyage. And I love it. And every time I go to Astoria, I see something I haven't seen. I do think about the fur traders. I do think about the war. I think about the logging. But this place is really remarkable. I'm certainly not a native of Astoria. It can be a tough place. I get the feeling sometimes that it's not enough to be born and raised here. your grandparents, your mother, your father, your uncle, your great-grandparents, your great-great-grandparents. As a matter of fact, anyone of your lineage who settled this country, if you didn't live here, you're not an historian. But this place has come a long way. But it's not just the great restaurants, and they're wonderful ones. It's not just the jewel of the Liberty Theater, because when I came to Liberty, you could see how tragic it was and how beautiful it is today. And I was, Steve, you spent a lot of time, and it really has paid off. That is the epicenter of this city, and it's beautiful. It's beautiful. But I feel that it's been reborn. It hasn't sacrificed yet, because it's a danger, as any so-called resort town is, vacation town. It still has not sacrificed, to me, its heart and soul. And I hope it doesn't. And what I see, and I see this through Lisa, who's so committed to young artists, and to Dulcie, and to Cindy, and to everyone here, is incredible commitment. Fanatic commitment. But commitment by so many to make Astoria special, to retain its integrity, and not just to make it a leading art showcase in the region, maybe even in the country, but really a place where talented young artists can come and feel at home and thrive. And this isn't to say Astoria does have problems. These are the problems that comes with growth, that comes with prosperity, affordable housing for the rock soul, the bedrock of the community, those who work here and those who live here. Because as a place grows and prospers, as Astoria has done, so do prices, often to the detriment of those who truly live here. And so Astoria, as it grows, you cannot sell your soul out to the vacationers, because I've seen that happen, and that can be devastating. I am from the East Coast. I've said this now about a million times. And look, let's face it, there is a cultural difference. My sense of humor and temperament, I will admit, tends to be cynical, bitter, negative, fatalistic.
To say the least.
All right, you're out. And yet, for reasons I cannot comprehend, I never get invited to any parties. Because I'm like the dead life of the party. If you're depressed, talk to me, you'll feel better. But, and the bottom line is that I continue to do in Astoria, I continue to do in the Northwest what I've done all my life as a writer. I observe it, I get excited by it, I do feel a kind of wonderful and profound stimulation. And I do wonder at the stories that are here to be told. I feel there's a great story to be told in the story if you can find the right hook. We've all read probably the Calvin Trillin piece in The New Yorker, and I wish he hadn't done it, because the history of the, there's something I know to be done. Because it is in feeling a connection to a place, an emotional and spiritual connection and commitment, that I, and I think most writers and most artists and most creators and most anyone, politicians, lawyers, whatever, I think it's when you feel that commitment, you feel that connection, you're going to do your best work. And it's rare. It doesn't happen all the time. So at the risk of being indulgent, I want to close. This is the section of an essay I wrote, and it was part of an anthology about Central Park in New York. I was very fortunate in my life. Our apartment overlooked Central Park, and we were there. Parents started renting it in 1957, and we had it for close to 45 years. I actually think, and people ask, what's the best thing you've ever written? And I think this may be close. In a lifetime of many, many words, probably too many. I do know that it wrote itself, that it came to me in a matter of minutes. Because I was writing about a place much like a story that to me was true and authentic. So I thought I would close with this. I could not imagine life without Central Park. I could not imagine waking up and making a cup of coffee and going into the living room and not staring out the window into that panorama. It was just as spectacular at night the twinkling lights of the grand concrete dowagers of Fifth Avenue across the way. I spent hours wondering what went on inside those windows. I imagined fanciful and perfect lives. Girls from Tony private schools in cotton nightgowns having pillow fights before dropping acid, and parents instructing the maid to give them all a kiss goodnight as they went off to Swifties or Rutes or some other fancy restaurant, and the girls now having moved on to dope. Often at night, my father and I would sit in softback chairs opposite each other in the living room, flanked by the picture window of the spectacular park. We talked about our lives. The glasses of scotch came closer and closer to the brim with each iteration until we both agreed that we were too drunk to make any coherent sense and needed to sleep it off. I never felt closer to my family than I did in those moments, even in the throes of inebriation. I thought we would last forever. In a way I cannot quite explain, I felt a sense of immortality because to me, Central Park was immortal, that everything would always stay the same. Until June of 2001, when I received my weekly call from my dad. Just checking in was the way he always started the conversation, in an upbeat lilt, to which I generally responded with some bitch and moan about work until he finally decreed that I would have exactly 5 minutes to bitch and moan about work until I was required to turn to something else. But this call was different. He had just been diagnosed with acute myeloid leukemia and was subsequently hospitalized. On the taxi ride to Mount Sinai Hospital, he let out a wail and said he was scared. It was the first time he had ever shown such vulnerability. I took his hand and I tried to console him, but I was utterly unprepared for the role reversal that inevitably takes place when your father becomes sick. And you, the son, try to become the caregiver. After fighting and after being filled with chemotherapy, he actually came home. He fought valiantly. He refused to accept that he even had leukemia, but it was fire in his blood, and there was an inevitable recurrence. He went back into the hospital. He knew it was over. We both knew it was over. I could offer no possible reassurance now, only the silence of fate. And he died in October of 2001. My mother had collapsed mentally and physically. She could not walk. She was incontinent. She often called out to my father, thinking he was still coming home at any second, or that he was still there in the apartment. My sister and I groped for ways to connect her with the things about New York that she had always loved as a lifelong New Yorker. So almost every day, we took her to Central Park in her wheelchair. We parked near a bench. We always picked a spot in walking distance of a hot dog stand. She still loved to eat, so we all got hot dogs and sodas. The sun fell on her face, and she felt tranquil in those moments. The place of New York she loved the best, among so many. We took her to a neurologist. He thought she might be suffering from hydrocephalus and a normal buildup of fluid in the brain. A shunt was put in to relieve the pressure, but she was 75, and it worked momentarily. She was even able to walk a little bit. But then she lapsed and had to be hospitalized. The shunt became infected and sepsis set in, leading to liver failure. Four months after my mother died in March. We had to leave the apartment. It was rent stabilized. The landlord was happy they were dead. It gave him the opportunity to raise the rent from $2,700 a month to over $10,000 a month. I was the only one there when the apartment was finally swept clean. I puttered about, going into each of the rooms before ending up in the living room. That living room where I'd spent so many hours. I stared out that magnificent picture window. Central Park unfolded like a magic carpet. I could see the joggers and the dog walkers. I could see the Guggenheim Museum and the spires, the great spires of Fifth Avenue. So I lingered for another second or two. Then I went to the front door and opened it and heard the click of the lock for the final time. Central Park beckoned. It always beckoned. But like so much else, the loss of my parents, the childhood so distant, the memories now nostalgic, it would never, ever be mine again. Thank you. So there are certainly time for questions, anything and everything, and feel free to ask about Caitlyn Jenner. The name of the book is called The Secrets of My Life. It's her book. I obviously did a lot of the writing, but everything is really from her lips. And I'm proud of it. I think she was true to her word. I said I would only do it if she was honest and candid, and I feel that she has been. And that book is coming out April 25th, and then we're going to go on a 8-day book tour from hell, because I have to be with her for 8 days and she talks constantly. But any questions you might have, I'm happy to answer.
You haven't talked about your work as a contributing editor for Vanity Fair. One of the pieces you wrote, I've always found fascinating, Shattered Glass, which in turn was turned into a movie. And the hero of the piece is somebody who
found
out that I knew before I knew Chuck Langlands. Tell us a little bit about Shattered Glass and how you came to know Chuck.
Well, Vanity Fair, you know, the business of publishing, and you all know this, the business of publishing in newspapers and magazines has changed radically. I like to think Vanity Fair has gone through a lot of pain. It's gone through contractions. There's the whole issue of the website and how to make money from it. I'm not going to lie. It's not the same magazine it once was, but I still feel it's a great magazine to work at. Stephen Glass was a wunderkind journalist. He was in his 20s, and he was writing for the New York Times Magazine and the New Republic and was on NPR with Ira Glass. And everyone was envious of him, including me. He had a skyrocket. He had just skyrocketed in terms of career until it was later discovered that he had made up most of the stories that he had written. He had figured out a way to get editors to like the stuff that he was writing. So the more outrageous he was, the more silly he was, the more conniving he was, the more insulting he was to other people, the more praise he got until he was discovered. So the story was a recreation of how basically what Stephen Glass had done and how he was caught. And, you know, you always look for certain angles in stories, and I really tried to write it like a mystery. And the protagonist was someone named Chuck Lane, who's now an editorial writer for the Washington Post, and Josh and Chuck have become good friends. And if you're ever looking for a movie late at night, it's a terrific movie with a terrific cast. It's very, 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 very well done. I, you know, people ask, I've been lucky to have two books made, a book and a magazine piece made in the films, and I've had nothing to do with any of them. They pay the writer money to get the hell away. And I'm happy to take the money. Writers always bitch and moan, oh, they ruined my money. Well, then don't take the money, you know? Don't take it. I want the Benjamins. So this particular version is very, very true to the story as I knew it. And it's compelling, it's interesting, it's tragic, it's uplifting, and it's very, very well done.
But you did have a cameo.
I did. I had the shortest amount. I was in Friday Night Lights way at the end. I had the shortest amount of film time ever in the history of Hollywood. So you got to look really quick. But I am in there.
Yes, you did.
Questions? Sure.
So earlier this evening, you were talking about how Caitlyn Jenner has her pilot's license and has driven you around. What else have we forgotten about Caitlyn Jenner in the sort of...
Well, I mean, I think, you know, what compels me about a story like this, I mean, I think what we have forgotten, and I think, you're 19, right?
Yeah.
I don't think we remember. I mean, I think a number of us do, because it looks like it's a group of old farts like me, but I don't think people remember what a big deal Bruce Jenner was when he won the Olympics. The younger generation, the problem is, because of the age of celebrity and entertainment we live in, most people think of Caitlyn Jenner as, oh God, it's the idiotic father on the Kardashians. Bruce Jenner, this is a book really about pain. It's about the pain of not being able to be yourself. It's about the pain of not being able to express yourself. It's about the pain of not being able to be authentic. And in the case of Bruce Jenner, it was magnified 100 times by literally overnight becoming the American hero. This was 1976. This was the Olympics. It was the first Olympics that really used television as a conduit. He was profiled ad nauseum by ABC. He became the hope of the United States. He had a beautiful blonde-haired wife. And he won the decathlon on live television. And he smote the Russians. And the Olympics up to then had been very embarrassing for the United States, and the Cold War was measured by Olympic performance. Overnight, he became an absolute sensation, and he said, what that did was make the box and the prison surrounding me even harder to ever get rid of. And, you know, is the book filled with revelation? No. I don't think it is, but I think it's the total whole story of how you come to grips with who you are, how you overcome the fear of the ignorance of others. Look, I paint my nails. The chicks love it. The white men hate it. And the African Americans are really cool about it. But I know that people look at me like, what's wrong with that guy? Why does he paint his nails? Does that mean he's gay? Does that mean he's neuter? Does that mean he's green? Does that mean, you know, constant judgments? Does that mean he's a transgender man? Constant, constant arbitrary judgments. And for Caitlyn, she fought this for 66 years. And her politics suck. Her politics are disturbing. I've talked to her about it. It's not worth it. But I think that because of her politics, it should not subsume the fact and take over the fact that it is because of her and her story and the willingness of her to go public that the word transgender has been introduced into the vernacular. It would never, ever happen without her. And she is truly committed, I think, to the cause of it. But there were some terrible, the whole 1980s, she became a hermit. She went underground. But, you know, just think about it. She was so desperate for any moment to be herself that what she would do is she would drive from Malibu to Los Angeles Airport, which is about 40 miles. It can often take 2 hours. She would park the car. She was dressed as a woman. And she would simply walk along the sidewalk of the terminal just for 10 or 15 minutes, just to feel what it would be like. She could not go into the terminal because it was too bright. And she was too terrified of getting discovered. And this is the way she lived. You know, she would go to the movies by herself, and she went as a woman. And she had to go to the bathroom. And the line, the women's room, the line was enormous. And she was terrified. So she had to run back to her hotel room. She would drive around in the car in women's clothing, and she would park at a mall, and she would pick the place in the mall that was the furthest away from any buildings. And the place that had no lights, just so she could walk around. And she was always holding her keys at all times in case someone spotted her. And this is how she lived her life until she basically said, I do not want to die without having experienced who I always knew who I was. And that, to me, whether you like her or don't, doesn't really matter. To me, that's a powerful story for all of us about it's very hard to be different in this country. It's a very judgmental country. Because of, I don't want to get into politics, but I think our tolerance is becoming less and less and less. And, you know, so I appreciate the journey that, that she's made.
How did you come to work with Caitlyn Jenner on her book?
It's a good question. You know, I wrote the Vanity Fair piece in which she basically announced her transition and the wonderful pictures by Annie Leibovitz and the fact that she, you know, called me Caitlin. And I started that piece in March, I guess, of 2015, and we just really hit it off. We hit it off, you know, I found her likable. She is likable. She's very likable. If you met her here, you would instantly like her. She's very accessible. She's very down to earth. She's very friendly, and we had fun. And, you know, I'm not normal myself, whatever the hell that means, and I don't know what it means. And she likes that, and you, normally I'm dressed in leather, but I'm not tonight. And, you know, she would get a kick out of that. And then we could tease each other and have fun with each other. And I don't know now if she's my sister, my mother, my distant cousin, or but we have a very, very close relationship. And when she decided to do the book, she asked if I would collaborate. And I thought about it. These are, you know, for a serious journalist, these can be very, very troubling. They can be complicated. I had done one before with LeBron James. It was a disaster. He didn't really care about it. And I didn't really care about it. So I remember saying to Caitlin, look, if you're going to do this, you got to be honest. You got to be candid. You cannot hold anything back. That doesn't mean you're going to be mean-spirited. It doesn't mean that you're going to be gossipy or salacious. But you can't hold back. And she was true to her word. And so I think for what it is, I think it really is a good book. Sure.
You identify yourself as a journalist, but at what point does your writing become art? And is this honesty a part of your art? Is that when it becomes art?
I don't think what I do is art. I just don't. I think you know about this because you're an artist. I think all artists to some degree think we're a fraud or that it's accidental or that it's never going to happen again. I go through that all the time when I write something that I like the Central Park piece or like Friday Night Lights or like Father's Day. And I always say it's an accident. It's accidental. It's never going to happen again. Or whatever resources I had to do it have fled. I do think if there's anything that makes me distinctive, it is the combination of both. I am a good writer, and I'm a good journalist, and I have a certain power with words to make those vivid images come alive. So I think it goes hand in hand. So I just don't think of myself as an artist. I wish I was, but I've never thought of myself, never really thought of myself that way. Because journalist is plodding forward. You know, it's interviewing, as I say. It's about having legs. It's about looking up documents. It's about knocking on doors. It's about people hating you. It's about people loving you. It's, you know, it's gritty work. Gritty work. What time is it now? Oh, all right. One or two more. I don't.
A lot of your subjects are sports or sports figures. Does that just happenstance, or are you attracted to?
I mean, I loved sports as a child. It was really the basis for my relationship with my father. He had gone to Dartmouth back in the days when they actually played Ivy League football, and it was pretty good. And one weekend, we went to three games. We went to the Dartmouth game in Hanover, New Hampshire. Then we went to the Jets game that Saturday night, and then we went to the Giants game that Sunday. That was like the best weekend ever of my life, I think. So I love sports, and I was a sports editor in college, but then I went into straight news reporting. I don't really consider myself a sports writer. I consider myself who really likes to examine the sociology and impact of sports in our culture, which I think is enormous and very much underrated. I was asked by the reporter from the Daily Historian, you know, what is the common theme of the pieces you write? And to me, it's just finding a good story, finding a good narrative, finding that something has a beginning and a middle and an end, a story that you can tell that gives you the spine, and then putting meat on the bone, so to speak, with reporting and plot and character. And, you know, people also, you know, what are you going to do now? I still do work for Vanity Fair. I'm about to embark on a profile of Serena Williams for Vanity Fair, which I think will be fun. I'm not supposed to, should I tell them?
About the cover photo?
Yeah. All right, you're not supposed to know this, and I'll get fired.
You swore to secrecy, everybody in this room is your son.
Yeah, well, the only person I'm worried about is you. She's pregnant, and I don't know how many people remember the famous Vanity Fair cover of Demi Moore. She's going to replicate that. So Annie Leibovitz is taking the pictures, and so once again, I'm reduced to a footnote.
That's okay.
But I'm looking forward to that, and I have a book idea in mind. It's about actually football and war and honor and patriotism. But it's complicated because, sadly, there are not many of those men left. And so I don't know if I can really tell their stories as they should be told. So that's not sports. So I sort of alternate. David Halberstam, the great David Halberstam, did the same thing. Michael Lewis also, you know, he'll do sports and he'll do non-sports. So. Sure.
I saw Shattered Glass, and one thing it didn't seem to go into was why the Stephen Glass chose to do fabricated stories.
Well, you know, the thing is, as a writer, first of all, I'm not sure if he knows. You know, I don't really like to play the role of pop psychologist. I mean, I think he felt a lot of pressure. I do think he felt a lot of pressure to succeed, particularly from his mother. I do know that he was pre-med at Penn and flunked and had to switch disciplines. And I think he was a kid like many now in college who was just determined to get ahead and was willing to do anything to do it. And like many things in life, did it once. I'm not going to do it again. It worked. He found out a system and a way to do it, and it worked. And then you get a reputation, and then you keep doing it. You know, if he was here and you asked him that question, I'm not sure he would give you a credible answer. And I don't really care, because I think what he did was awful and unconscionable and disgrace to all journalists everywhere. Journalism is hard work. It could be really boring. It could be really, really methodical. And he made a mockery out of all of us. So. Sure.
Do you want to comment on what's going on right now with the alternate facts and political climate?
Well, the only thing, I mean, as a journalist, what disturbs me is we've somehow, some way, have gotten to the point where there are no facts anymore. There literally are no facts. I don't know if it's because of, there's so many different versions on the internet. I don't know if it's because of anger, but we are a country and a society and a world that no longer deals in fact. We only deal in what we want to believe, and because of the internet, there are always a source somewhere that will prove that belief. And that's terrifying. That's terrifying. And even if a fact is proven, I think it is a climate in which too many people will say, well, that doesn't matter. That doesn't care. And I don't want to get into this, but I really, really, truly believe that if Donald Trump, if it was proven, if it was on tape that he had raped someone, his supporters would say she deserved it. Yeah. And I think that is the level we have gone to. And I do think that what hurt the media terribly was the way in which they blew, and maybe that's too strong a word, but did not see what was coming. And so I think the New York Times, frankly, really got hurt by this. And I don't think it's recovered. I think the Washington Post has really recovered. And the good news about journalism, when Jeff Bezos bought the Washington Post, people were terrified. It's Bezos, it's Amazon, he's going to cut corners, all he wants to do is make money. Well, in fact, it's been the opposite. He's hired 200 people, the paper is thriving, and the coverage is great. And I think the Times is still trying to find itself. But there are no facts. And when there are no facts, then you are going to make things up. And the Trump has been very effective at that to a point. But I am confident that he's one and done, because I think his biggest fundamental problem is he's really stupid.
Yes.
I mean, I don't care about, you know, he's narcissistic and couldn't, he's a stupid man. He's a stupid man, and I think people are finally sort of figuring it out. I hope. But I think so. And I think the country is churning. And, you know, we've survived worse. We survived Vietnam. We survived Nixon. We survived Johnson, who was very complex. And I have belief in our republic and our country to get through this. I really do. One more question. Sure. I mean, anyone else who... Sure. Oh, take one back. What goes on in the Chelsea stays in the Chelsea. No, but I actually have seen it recently. No, I don't. God, I wish I did. But it's still, you know, there are people who are still living there. And so far, they have actually been successfully fought off the development into a condominium. It's going to happen. But they're basically squatters, and they won't leave, and the city won't evict them. But it certainly is not the same as it once was. You know, the Chelsea was one of the great bohemian repositories of all time. And that's the I love New York, but New York has changed. New York is almost completely, I think, gentrified. And I think the singularity of New York, the funkiness of New York, the bohemian side of New York is gone. And I think Astoria has all of that, and let's retain it. And I'll stop there.